Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Hare Rama, Hare Rama.
Sarvai Rajagacharya Asatara Sarasisha Mahas Devanga Sesi Bhakti Vedanta Swami Maharaj Prabhupada Ki Jai. ISKCON Founder Acharya Shila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Nantakoti Vaishnava Vrinda Ki Jai. Namacharya Chilari Das Thakur Ki Jai. Prem Shikhoshi Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Adwaita Gadadhar Shri Vasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai. Shri Shri Radha Krishna Gaur Gopinath Sharma Kunda Radha Kunda Giri Govardhana Ki Jai, Vrindavan Dhamma Ki Jai, Mathura Dhamma Ki Jai, Navadvip Mayapur Dhamma Ki Jai, Jagannath Puri Dhamma Ki Jai, Gangamaya Jamuna Devi Ki Jai, Bhakti Devi Ki Jai, Tulsi Maharani Ki Jai, Samaveta Bhakti Vrinda Ki Jai, Gaura Premananda. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Sri Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnupadaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Shri Mate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namane Namaste Sarasvati Deve Gauravani Pachani Nivasesa Sunivani Paskachadri Satani Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yuta Padakamalam Shri Guru and Vaishnavascha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sagana Yavanatam Vitam Samsajivam Sadvaitam Sadvajutam Padichana Saita Krishna Chaitanya Deva Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sagana Lalita Shri Vishakam Vitam Shri Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
It's March 3rd, 2013. We are in Lanesia, Johannesburg, South Africa, reading from Bhagavad Gita, chapter 7, text 14. So I know you don't have it on the board, but maybe you could repeat. Daivyesha gunamayi. Mama maya dirachaya. Mam evaye prapadyante. Mayametam tarantite. Daivi. Transcendental. He. Certainly. Esha. This. Gunamayi. Consisting of the three modes of material nature. Mama. My. Maya. Energy. Jirachaya. Very difficult to overcome. Mam, unto me, Eva, certainly, yea, those who, prapadyante, surrender, mayam etam, this illusory energy, taranti, overcome, te, they. Translation purport by Srila Prabhupada. This divine energy of mind, Krishna spoke, consisting of the three modes of material nature, is difficult to overcome. But those who have surrendered unto me can easily cross beyond it. By the way, children are welcome unless they scream. Okay, that may be me in 50 years. So be nice. Purport. The Supreme Personality of Godhead has innumerable energies, and all of these energies are divine. Although the living entities are part of his energies and are therefore divine, due to contact with material energy, their original superior power is covered. So we have what? What do we have? What did Prabhupada say we have? Oh, come on. Shall I read it again?
Yes.
Okay. Come on, guys. I mean, I know it's Kali Yuga, but... The Supreme Personality of Godhead has innumerable energies, and all these energies are?
Divine.
Although the living entities are part of his energies, and are therefore... The energies are all divine. So we are therefore?
Divine.
Due to contact with material energy, their original spiritual power is covered. So what do we have that's covered? Spiritual power. Isn't that nice? Isn't that nice to know? We're all divine. With spiritual power. What is that echo?
Being thus covered by material energy, one cannot possibly overcome its influence. Oh, no. We're divine, we have spiritual power, but we cannot possibly overcome its influence. Pretty depressing. First it was exciting. I'm divine! I've got spiritual power! Oh, but I can't possibly overcome the influence of material energy. As previously stated, both material and spiritual natures, being emanations from the Supreme Personality of Godhead, are eternal. We are eternal. We're not created. We don't have a beginning. The living entities belong to the eternal superior nature of the Lord. But due to being contamination by the inferior nature of matter, their illusion is also eternal. The conditioned soul is therefore called Nityabhata, or eternally conditioned. No one can trace out the history of his becoming conditioned at a certain date in material history. So Prabhupada's explaining what's the meaning of eternal. The meaning of eternal in this sense is that we can't look at material history and find out a date. So why is that? Because our conditioning is outside of material history. It's outside of time. Consequently, his release from the clutches of material nature is very difficult. Oh, well, that's a little better. Before he said we cannot possibly do it, now he says it's very difficult, so it's gotten a little easier. Even though that material nature is an inferior energy, so material nature is inferior to us, yet it's very difficult, basically impossible, for us to get out of it. Why? Because material energy is ultimately conducted by the Supreme Will, which the living entity cannot overcome. So the problem is not the material energy. We are superior to material energy. Material energy is inferior to us. So we should be able to overcome it. But why can't we overcome it? The Lord's will. Because it's being done by the Lord's will, and we can't overcome the Lord's will. We are subordinate to the Lord's will. Inferior material nature is defined herein as divine nature due to its divine connection and movement by the divine will. Being conducted by divine will, material nature, although inferior, acts so wonderfully in the construction and destruction of the cosmic manifestation. It is pretty wonderful, isn't it? Even we saw the sunset yesterday. It was beautiful. The Vedas confirm this as follows. Mayam tu prakritim vidyam, mayinam tu maheshwaram. Although maya, illusion, is false or temporary, the background of maya is a supreme magician, the personality of Godhead, who is Maheshwara, the supreme controller. So this far, Upanishad 4:10. Another meaning of guna is rope. It is to be understood that the conditioned soul is tightly tied by the ropes of illusion. A man tied by the hands and feet cannot help himself. So here's another explanation of why we can't get out of maya by ourselves. So the first was because maya is conducted by the supreme will. Here's another analogy given. A man bound by the hands and feet cannot help himself. He must be held by a person who is unbound. Because the bound cannot help the bound, the rescuer must be liberated. Therefore, only Lord Krishna, or his bona fide representative, the spiritual master, can release the conditioned soul. Without such superior help, we cannot be free from the bondage of material nature. So now we have, how do you get free? Somebody will say, well, do we have to stay there forever? So here, no one can get free by how? By? Now, how do we get free? Help of someone who's liberated. So the help of Krishna or a jiva who's liberated. Devotional service or Krishna consciousness can help one gain such release. Krishna, being the Lord of the illusory energy, can order this insurmountable energy to release the conditioned soul. He orders this release out of his causeless mercy on the surrendered soul and out of his paternal affection for the living entity who was originally a beloved son of the Lord. So here Prabhupada first says that our conditioning is eternal, and then he says we're originally a beloved son of the Lord. So it makes it very clear that this eternal means beyond material conceptions of time. If we were literally eternally conditioned, You couldn't say we were originally a beloved son of the Lord. Therefore, surrender unto the lotus feet of the Lord is the only means to get free from the clutches of the stringent material nature. So what's the only way out? Surrender to the Lord. The words Mam Eva are also significant. Mam means unto Krishna, Vishnu only, and not Brahma or Shiva. Although Brahma and Shiva are greatly elevated and are almost on the level of Vishnu, it is not possible for such incarnations of Rajagun passion and Tamagun ignorance to release the conditioned soul from the clutches of Maya. Please try to welcome the children. They're the future of our movement. Therefore, he alone can give release to the conditioned souls. The Vedas, Svetasvara Upanishad 3.8, confirm this in the phrase, Tam Eva Viditva, or freedom is possible only by understanding Krishna. Even Lord Shiva affirms that liberation can be achieved only by the mercy of Vishnu. Lord Shiva says, Mukti Padata Sarvesha Vishnu Eva Na Samsaya. There is no doubt that Vishnu is the deliverer of liberation for everyone. Of course, we can mention that if you see Brahma or Shiva as a Vaishnava, they're also guru. We'll get to that in a minute. Daviyesha Vinamayi Mama Maya Dharatyaya Mam Evaye Prapadyante Mayam Etam Dharatyate. This divine energy of mind, consisting of the three modes of material nature, is difficult to overcome, but those who have surrendered unto me can easily cross beyond it. So most people in this world have no idea that they're under the control of an illusory energy. They haven't a clue. Most people are going around the world thinking, I am this body, I am Mr. Singh, I am, you know, Mrs. Smith, this is who I am, this is what I look like, I have brown eyes, and I have, you know, whatever. I weigh this amount, I live in this place, I come from this family, and that's reality. Yes? Most people are thinking that's reality. What I perceive with my senses is the same as reality. And I am the controller of my life. I can decide what I want to do, I can decide the results of my life, and, you know, life isn't exactly what I want, but I try to make the best of it. If they're a religious person, they'll say things like, well, you know, I see whatever I have is the Lord's blessings. And if they're a materialistic person, they say, well, I'm always trying to improve my life and so forth. So most people haven't the foggiest notion that they're an illusion. I mean, they have a little bit of hint every once in a while, but then they repress that. So most people have a little intuition, a little indication every once in a while. And they work really, 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 really hard to get a job, and then they get the job, and it's a great job, and then they say, that's it? Isn't it supposed to be more satisfying than that? Right? You marry the perfect person, and they're beautiful, and you have a great wedding, and you know, it's, and you think, yes, now my life is going to be wonderful, and even if it's a very nice relationship, after a while you say, that's it? That's it? I don't feel this complete, utter, total satisfaction. You get the beautiful house right by the ocean, right in Cape Town by the ocean. It's a nice house, and you live in it. Yes, now I'm happy. And then you say, that's it? So every once in a while, even a materialistic person gets some little indication that some things are illusory. That what things appear to be and what they actually are quite different. What things appear to be and what they actually are quite different. You know, I remember one time one of my mother's friends telling me how she walked past a shop and saw her reflection in the window and thought, who's that old lady? Oh my God, it's me. And she was telling me, she said, I don't feel like an old lady. So again, we have these little indications that there's something funny. Something's funny here. But if you're a materialistic person, you sort of push those aside and say, oh, well, you know, okay, the house by the sea didn't fully satisfy me. Maybe I just have to get a new couch. Maybe I have to get a new TV. Then I'll be satisfied. Oh, that didn't satisfy me? oh, now I have to get a new car. Well, that didn't satisfy. Maybe I have to do this. Well, that didn't satisfy. Now I have to do this. And they don't figure out that the whole thing is an illusion. Now, some people, Manusyanam Sahasrasya Kastadyati Siddhani, at the time Apisiddhanam, Kastadyam Vedithapitam. Some people say, what's going on here? What's happening here? Why is it that I do everything I'm told to do to be happy, and all I get is momentary, I get brief, incomplete bits of happiness, and that's all? Has anyone here materially ever had expansive, ever-increasing, unlimited happiness on a material level? Funny, isn't it? Because that's what we're told by the materialistic society will happen. When you're a kid, you're told, just study well in school. Then you'll get it. Get a good job. Get a good family. Get a nice house. Do something for society. Be religious. You know, go to a church or a mosque or a temple once a week and say a little prayers, you know. And then you'll get it. And some people wake up and say, I'm not getting it. And I'm not going to get it this way. I'm not going to get full satisfaction and full knowledge and full vibrancy and perfect relationships and all the things I want and all the things that are promised. I'm just not going to get it this way at all. It doesn't matter what degrees I have and what job I have and who I marry and what kids I have and what career I have and where my house is and what furniture I have and what electronics I have and what my body looks like. It just doesn't matter. I'm just not going to get it that way. And what religion I belong to and what little, you know, it's not going to make it. What kind of government I'm under, if I'm under. You know, we'll get it if we're under a communist government. Then we'll get the full satisfaction, right? If we get a democratic government, then we'll get the full satisfaction. I move to a different country. And some people wake up and say, it's none of that. It just isn't any of that. Something's wrong here. There's something that's not right. And I want to find out what it is. I want to find out the truth. I'm tired of things being inauthentic. You know, one gradually realizes everything here is inauthentic. It's real, but it's not what it appears to be. It's like, you know, somebody selling you a piece of aluminum and telling you it's silver. It's real, but it's not what it appears to be. And one starts to realize that I'm also inauthentic. That the persona that I project to the world and what I really am is not the same. And you start to see that about all institutions in the world. Oh, we're doing this. We teach this. We have these ethics. We have this thing. And then you actually join the business or the school or whatever, and you say, whoa, what's really happening here and what they say is happening here are not the same. The way the nice family appears in the photograph and the way the family is when you live with them is not the same. The travel brochures about this wonderful place and what it's actually like when you get there are not the same. And you realize it's true for everything. And it's not just true about everybody else, it's true about me too. What I project I am and what I actually am are not the same. Unless I want something more. And what I really want, okay, what do I really want? And it's interesting that what we all really want the same things. We all really want to be happy. And we don't want just like blah happiness. You know, okay, nothing hurts right now. We don't just want that. We want vibrant happiness. We want, you know, in our Krishna consciousness movement, we often use words like bliss and ecstasy. Ecstatic. That's what we want. We want ecstasy. You know, it's very interesting that in most civilized societies, people learn that they're not supposed to exhibit very strong emotions. Yes? You're supposed to, like, control your emotions. But people want extreme emotions, and so therefore they are some places, like sporting events or entertainment events or something like that, where people are given license to display strong emotions. But that's what we want. We want to be carried away with happiness. We want intense love. We want to be crazy in love. You know, sometimes we're crazy in love for a while, but it doesn't generally last. Yes? Those of us who've been crazy in love, in romantic love, and, you know, after a year or two, it sort of mellows. You know, at first you're willing to, like, climb Mount Everest for the person. After a while, you're not sure if you're willing to go to the store. But we want something where that intensity sustains, right? So some people, they try to, like, change partners every couple years to try to keep that going. But that's what we're looking for. We're looking for intense, incredible happiness that doesn't have any boundaries. Krishna's talked about this in the previous chapter, in chapter 6. Boundless transcendental happiness. We want love that we feel that we can give ourselves completely, that we're overwhelmed in love, and it keeps increasing instead of decreasing. We want great knowledge. We really want to understand things. You know, we're all curious. You look at little children, they're very curious. Our nature, very curious. We always want to learn more, to understand more, to figure things out, to solve the mysteries, to know how everything works. And we want to feel alive. We want to feel full of life and energy and health, right? Forever. And everybody wants these things. These are universal desires. And these are desires that can't be fulfilled on the material platform. It can't be. You cannot find through the body and the mind these things. So a little bit of a thoughtful person says, wait a minute, what everybody wants, is something that cannot be achieved on a bodily and mental level. The body is not capable, the mind is not capable, it just isn't capable, of enjoying unlimited, ever-expanding, boundless happiness. It just isn't. We're not really capable on a material level of having unlimited loving relationships that keep getting better and better and better and expanding and expanding and expanding. We're not capable with the material body and mind of having, you know, unlimited knowledge. We can try to travel all over the universe and look at this and that, but scientific knowledge is constantly, they're constantly discovering where they're wrong. It's not like with empirical knowledge, you know this much, and then you know this much, and then you know this much. What they really, they know this, and then they see something over here, and they say, oh, this must be wrong, and then they look over here. And they look over here, and they look over here. It keeps expanding. And on the level of the body and mind, I can't have vibrant, youthful, healthy life eternally. The body's going to get old. It's going to get damaged. It doesn't take much to damage one of these bodies, does it? Sometimes I feel like it's made out of glass. You know, it's a really delicate thing. It doesn't take much for us to get sick. And no matter what you do, you're going to get old. You know, no matter how healthy you are and how careful you are. Right? And then the body's going to die. So someone who's a little thoughtful can say, wait a minute, I must be of a nature that's different from this world because I want things that are not possible in this world. Does that logic make sense to everybody? Now, some people might say, well, if I want things that aren't possible in this world, then I just have to train myself not to want them. So if somebody wakes up a little bit and starts saying, oh, I want all these impossible things. I want unlimited happiness. I want perfect loving relationships. I want unlimited knowledge. I want power. Your Prabhupada's talking about power, spiritual power. I want great power. I want energy, vitality. But I can't get them the way I want. Okay, let me just learn how to be satisfied with, you know. So again, the materialists, whenever those things come up, they push them down. I'm just going to learn to be satisfied with not having my real desires fulfilled. But some people say, oh, no, I'm not going to be satisfied. I'm going to actually look for those things. And I must have to look for them beyond matter. I can't find them in matter. They just don't exist there. You think you go to a desert, you know, you're not going to find watermelons. Just not there. They don't grow there. You're not going to find elephants in the middle of the ocean. I mean, you just realize I'm not going to find it. It's not here. It's not in materialism. It's not in the body or the mind. And then one starts asking the question, well, how do I get that? Okay, I can't get it materially. Figure that out. All right. How do I get it? But the problem we then run into is that the material energy, although illusory, and although not our real self, and although inferior to us, is the energy of the divine. And so our own attempts to get out of illusion strictly on our own power are not going to work. Now, there are mechanical means for getting out of illusion. But even they need the touch of the will of the divine. So, for example, the Asanga Yoga system, that's a mechanical way to get out of illusion. By putting your body in a certain posture and breathing in a certain way, you change the actions of the life air and the mind. And by changing the actions of the life air and the mind, you're able to put your mind intelligence in a different state of consciousness, called Turiya, beyond wakefulness, dreaming, and deep sleep. And in that state of consciousness, you can get an awareness of the spiritual beyond the mundane. But to actually fully enter into the spiritual and stay there requires something more than mechanics. Therefore, we say that those who just take that path and enter into the spiritual that way, we say in the Bhagavatam, avasuddha buddhiya. Suddha means pure, buddhi means intelligence. Avasuddha means not. That they still don't have purified intelligence. Now here we're learning that if we really want to find the authentic reality, our authentic self, our real place, we have to get the permission, the will, the grace of the person who's controlling the illusion. Now, to understand why that's true, we have to understand why we're in illusion in the first place. So, although it seems inconceivable to us, once we realize how terrible illusion is, we got into illusion because we wanted to be an illusion. It's exactly like there's one gentleman I know who became a heroin addict. So why did he become a heroin addict? Because he wanted to take heroin. Nobody forced him to. He had some interest. Maybe if I take this drug, I'll feel happy. And then after some time of taking the drug, he realized it's not making me happy, it's making me miserable. But getting out is not so easy. Yes, once people become addicted to alcohol or heroin or some intoxicant like that, can they just say, okay, today I'm going to stop, and then they just stop? Generally, they need the help of some sort of doctor, some sort of therapist. Very difficult to get out on their own. So it's something like that, that we had a desire, a foolish desire. We had a desire, and we cannot just put this in the past tense, although Srila Prabhupada talks about that the beginning of our conditioning happened before material time and space. But really, the desire must be present at present. Nitya nityanam chaitanya chaitanam eko bhavanam yo vidadati kama. Eko bhavanam yo vidadati kama. The one, supreme, is fulfilling the desires of all living entities. Krishna is fulfilling all of our desires. Krishna is fulfilling all of our desires. Krishna is fulfilling all of our desires. So if we are an illusion, my dear friends, I hate to say this, but if we are an illusion, it's because we want to be an illusion. It's very simple. Now, our reasons for being an illusion, for wanting to be an illusion, are foolish. But still, one gets to the point where one becomes mixed, where one starts saying, I don't really like the illusion. I'm suffering, but I'm not sure I really want to be totally out of the illusion either. So those are the people who are on the spiritual path. People on the spiritual path are people who are saying, I don't like illusion, it's making me suffer, but I'm not quite willing to walk away from it. I still have some fear, I still have some attachment. You know, I'm afraid. Maybe if I walk away from illusion, I'll have nothing. At least in illusion, I have an illusion of happiness, sometimes a little bit temporarily. Maybe if I walk away from illusion, I'll have nothing. Maybe walking away from illusion, I'll have to see what a complete, total, incredible idiot I was to want to be an illusion. Maybe I don't want to see that. I mean, most people are very hesitant to see even a teeny tiny fraction of ever having made a mistake for anything. I mean, how do we feel when it becomes obvious to us and others that we made a mistake? I mean, even a very small mistake that we said a date wrong or, right? How do we feel? I made a mistake. What to speak of if you have to face a really big mistake. Not just a little mistake, like, I forgot your name. Oh my goodness, that happened to me not that long ago. It was so embarrassing. Where I forgot somebody's name, and then I thought I remembered her name, but that was still the wrong name. Twice I got the wrong name. You know, it was in front of a whole bunch of other people. It was terrible. But that's such a little thing, right? What to speak of to get out of illusion. You have to look in the mirror, Chaitanya Dharpa Namarjana, you have to look in the mirror and go, I made the biggest mistake that anybody can ever possibly make. Nobody, it's not possible to make a bigger mistake than I made. It's not possible. I mean, the details may vary, but the general, you know, I gave up my divine power. I gave up my position of being eternal, full of knowledge and full of bliss, and the beloved Son of the Lord, to get a body made of blood, muscle, hair.
Wow.
So we're sort of conflicted. You know, we want to see the truth, we want to be in the truth, we want to see the truth, but we're not quite willing to give up the illusion to get there. So that is in the intermediate stage, that's the practitioner stage, so to speak. And those who try to get free of illusion mechanically are very much like that. Because the essence of illusion is that I'm not part of Krishna, I'm not part of God, I'm independent. That's the essential, you get to the root of what attracts illusion to cover us, what communicates to Krishna, I want to be covered with illusion. You know, is this mood of, I want to be separate from you. I no longer want to see you or connect with you. I want to make it on my own. Like sometimes a little child will say to their parents, I don't like you anymore, mommy. I want to run away and be on my own. Okay. Yes. Did many of us say that when we were little kids? Yes, I remember saying that. I wrote a little note to my parents. I've run away from home, but don't call the police because I'll be back later. Now we say, you know, I want to make it on my own. I don't want to be subordinate to God. So those who try to get out of illusion mechanically on their own power, they haven't gotten rid of this root They're still thinking, I'm going to be on my own. I'm going to be independent. We have spiritual power. But they're saying, I want independent spiritual power. So there's means to manipulate the material body and mind by which you can see at least the Brahman. You can do that mechanically. But you can't stay there. Because the root of Asuddha Buddhya, the root of the intelligence, is still contaminated with this essential idea that I'm separate. Truth is harmonious. Truth is not a bunch of separate living entities, all just separate from each other, each doing their own thing. The way one finds unlimited bliss is through connection. The way one finds unlimited knowledge is through connection. The way one finds unlimited life is through connection, and unlimited love is through connection, not through separateness. Now, connection implies that there's individuals who are being connected. Connected doesn't mean that you merge. But someone who wants to be free from illusion independently is still not making the connection. They still have this basic thing, I want to be separate. I want to have my own independent power. So therefore, if we really want to get free of illusion, we have to go to the root and say, I have my place in the Supreme Whole. I am a servant of Krishna. I am a part of Krishna. I'm a beloved, Prabhupada says here, beloved. I am beloved of Krishna. Krishna loves me. I am Krishna's beloved, and Krishna is my beloved. One replaces aham mameti. I am the enjoyer, I am the center, and my computer and my car and my family are mine, with I am the beloved of the Lord, and the Lord is my beloved. I am his and he is mine. And that is surrender. I talk about there's six parts of surrender. One part of surrender is we accept everything that's favorable for our loving relationship with Krishna. Another part is we reject anything that's not favorable for our loving relationship with Krishna. So the bottom line, that would be meat, fish, eggs, intoxication, illicit sex, and gambling. We become humble. Humility is just another word for authenticity. Humility is, I'm pretty insignificant because, again, I'm very sorry, we're all very insignificant. Really sorry about that. But we really are. And we really are. I mean, how many people really care what we do? You know, make an experiment. Go to your best friend or your favorite family member and say, let me tell you everything I did yesterday. And see if they'll sit down for an hour and listen. I mean, we're very, very insignificant. Really. We think we're so important. You ever been around somebody that was just talking on and on and on and on about themselves? Even if you like the person, you know, even if they're your friend, you like the person. And how tiny we are. You know, you just go up a little ways in an airplane, we all disappear. Isn't that interesting? I mean, even when you're very low to the ground, you see the cars, but you can't see the people. You have to practically land before you see the people. So the truth is, we're very insignificant. This is just one little planet, you know, to the entities of the rest of the universe. We're just a dot of light in the sky, the whole planet. Believe me, the people on the other planets, they don't know about South Africa. They don't even know it exists. With the speaker of Johannesburg or Malaysia. I mean, if I told most people in the world I'm in Malaysia, they go, where's that? Right? So the reality is we're very insignificant. Humility is just saying, oh, I'm really small. It's such a relief, though. Isn't it a relief to be authentic? Yeah? Find this in general? Don't you like having relationships where you can just be who you are and you don't have to pretend? Isn't that like, I don't have to pretend. So it's such a relief to be humble because, like, well, I don't have to pretend that I'm important. Because I'm not important. What a relief. and I have to put up this pretense of being important. Of course I'm important to Krishna. That's because he loves me. I was reading a story about a woman who found a little frog in her lettuce when she bought it from the shop. You know, a little tiny frog, and she felt sorry for it. She kept it alive for years, actually. A little tiny frog, you know, kept it as a little pet. So what's the significance of a little tiny frog in the world? But because she loved the frog, it was significant to her. You follow? Yes? So we're significant because Krishna loves us. And we have a place. We each have a unique place in his pastimes. We have a unique place in the cosmos that only we have, and nobody else can have it. So in that way, we're significant. And that's another part of humility. My significance is in my position as a servant. My power, my meaning, my specialness is in my rightful place in existence. So one has to come to that. That's the next thing, is surrender. So accepting everything favorable, rejecting everything favorable, being humble, being dependent. You know, we're already dependent. Again, I'm really sorry about this. But we're dependent. We're not the supreme controller. I hope I'm not offending anybody. You know, just like it was just Bhakti Sananda Saraswati's appearance day, and he used to always say, Krishna willing. You know, will you meet me at 4 o'clock? Sure. Can I guarantee I'm going to meet you at 4 o'clock?
No.
No. Can anybody here guarantee? If we make an appointment, we're going to meet at 4 o'clock. Can you guarantee? Can you promise? No. What do they say? There's so many things can slip between the cup and the lip. I'm not the controller. Sobering, isn't it? I'm not the controller. I can make so many plans. Frankly, I can't control whether I'm going to be alive in this body in 5 minutes. I mean, what to speak of anything else? So to feel dependent, the Lord is my maintainer. Because he is. He says elsewhere in the Gita, he joins with the life air to digest my food. So just pay attention a minute. You're breathing, right? Everybody's breathing? Are breathing? Everybody breathing? Yes? So that breath, that's Krishna. Can you feel that? That breath, that's Krishna. Yes? You there with your child. Hey, you in the green sari. In the green sari. Hare Krishna. Yes. In the green sari with the green necklace. Are you breathing? Feel that breath. It's Krishna. That breath is Krishna. It's actually Krishna. And our digestion. We're all digesting? Yes, I hope. Sometimes better than others. So that fire digestion, that's Krishna. The light of the sun. It's Krishna. That's what he says, right? Yes? You mean Bhagavad Gita? Yes. Okay. Krishna says he's the light of the sun. He said he's the heat in fire, the heat in our bodies, the warmth in this room. That's Krishna. He says he's the moonshine that gives the juice to vegetables. He says he's our ability. Our ability to sit. You know, some people can't sit. We take it for granted. Our ability to sit, we're all sitting. Our ability to hear, our ability to think. Mitasmatir gana rupo anarcha. That's Krishna. So surrender means I acknowledge that. I'm aware of it. I have a mood. Krishna, you're my maintainer. Prabhupada says that what we do for our livelihood, this is in Chaitanya Charitamrita with the story of Gaura the Hunter, that what we do for our livelihood is not the source of our income. So our income is Krishna. And Prabhupada says what we do for our livelihood is simply our choice. Krishna's maintaining. Krishna's paying my bills. Krishna's feeding me. So that's the next item of surrender. Because this verse was about surrender, right? Yes?
Yep.
Okay. Prepadente. To get out of illusion, you have to surrender. Surrender means I'm reestablishing the relationship. So Krishna's my maintainer. Krishna's my protector. He's my security. Not the armed response people. Maybe they'll show up, and maybe they won't. Maybe they'll show up 5 minutes too late. Oops, sorry, guys.
Hey, I didn't learn to laugh with all my stuff.
Krishna is my protector. And being surrendered to however Krishna maintains me, however Krishna protects me, is okay. I don't dictate to Krishna how to maintain me and protect me. And I'll say to Krishna, okay, I want this, and 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 I want this. Then I'm treating him like he's my servant. Now I can go to Krishna and ask, but not like that. I can go to Krishna and say, you know, Krishna, I'd really like it, if you want. That's nice. Krishna likes it. He doesn't mind. So Krishna is my protector, Krishna is my maintainer. And I'm always expecting Krishna's mercy. I know Krishna's going to be kind to me. I know Krishna loves me. I know I'm Krishna's beloved. I'm fully giving everything to Krishna. Using this body, which is after all not mine, the mind, the possessions, everything like that. That way we reconnect with Krishna, and that way we actually show Krishna very demonstratively that we want to reconnect with him. You know, wanting to get out of illusion is not just a matter of saying, I want to get out of illusion. But it's a question of showing, I really want to connect with you again, Krishna. You know, if someone's addicted to alcohol or heroin or something like that, and they just say, yeah, I'd really like to get free, but they don't join the treatment program, what does it mean? Not much. So if you just say, I want to get out of illusion, Krishna's going to say, okay. But if you say, all right, I'm going to go through the process of surrender, which is basically just reestablishing my loving relationship. And this process of surrender is taught to us by those who are already surrendered, by those who are free. We cannot become unbound by someone else who's also bound. So one who sees reality, who's functioning in the reality, who has their relationship with Krishna, they can instruct us, this is how you come back to reality. This is how you please Krishna. This is how you surrender to Krishna. And we surrender to that person not exactly the same way we surrender to Krishna, in the sense that we think that person is going to fulfill all of our desires and our needs and their maintainer and their our shelter, and not exactly like that. No other jiva is God. But we surrender to that person as a guide. We surrender to that person as a guide. Just like if you were blind and you needed to go to a place to get water, and somebody's guiding you there, and you're surrendering to the guide. So the guide is not the water. You follow? And then we conquer illusion. And then we're again in our position of divine power. Wouldn't that be nice? Sound nice? And how fast and how slow that happens is really mostly, not entirely, but mostly up to us. So generally the process is gradual because most of us can only take it gradually. Most of us are not willing to go through some sudden vision of truth. Because remember that seeing the truth isn't just seeing beautiful Krishna and Radharani and the gopis and the cowherd boys, and it isn't just seeing our original spiritual form, which is also beautiful and youthful and full of power, but it's also seeing our foolishness. It has to be, because that's part of what's true. And most of us are only willing to see that in small increments. Unfortunately. But Krishna's patient. Fortunately. So for most of us, it's a gradual process, and the degree of gradualness is very much dependent on our willingness to see truth. Because that's what we're saying. We want to say, I want to be out of illusion and see the truth, yes? So how much are we really willing to see truth? That's the question. So to whatever extent we're actually willing to see the truth, to the extent we're willing to see, as Prabhupada puts it in the first canto, the naked form of material desires. To that extent, we come into the reality. Therefore, Srila Prabhupada says, proportionately and gradually, our illusion, our process in Krishna consciousness is quite interesting. Our process, Prabhupada calls it, as proportionally and gradually. So in other processes, what they try to do, you start out, right, your idea of truth is very small, and your illusion is very big, huh? And their idea is, first stop all the illusion, and then you see the truth. So our Krishna conscious process is not like that. Our Krishna conscious process is become absorbed in the truth, and to the proportion you become absorbed in the truth, your illusion decreases. So it's gradually and proportionally, it's like this. That's the process of life. So our main way of becoming absorbed in the reality is to become absorbed in reality. Not to try to get rid of illusion, per se. But to try to reconnect with Krishna. And as we reconnect with Krishna, naturally the illusion recedes. So our willingness, our enthusiasm to reconnect with Krishna is what propels that process. And our holding on to the illusion is what slows it down. And at a certain point, then Krishna says, okay, done. He tells Maya, leave this person alone. They don't want you anymore. And then it's done. And thankfully, reality is not static, it's ecstatic, it's dynamic. So it's not that once you come into reality, then you're just floating in the reality. But one goes on and on further in a deep relationship with Krishna. So Maya is the world of falsity, the world of that which is not, the world of the facade. Something that looks good and isn't. The fancy-looking dessert made out of chemicals that gives you cancer. Looks good, but isn't good. The relationships where people appear to be loving and kind and generous and stab you in the back. The career that looks to be satisfying and is boring after a while. The beautiful house that you look at and after a while you realize you have to keep the plumbing going and pay the taxes. And things that what they look like and what they are not the same. And where in that position one cannot find what one wants. And just trying to get out by one's own power is not possible, because thinking that one can work by one's own power is the whole root of the problem. So one can get out only by going back to the root and reconnecting with the real, not by getting out of the illusion by force. And we reconnect with the real through love and surrender, with the help of the liberated souls. Is that all right? Yes? So is this our question sheet that's been passed around? I like the way you do that.
It's very cool that you do that.
When you do this, then people don't have to feel embarrassed, and you get questions from people who would otherwise not raise their hands. It's nice. It just, if there's something really off topic, I probably won't answer it. Please explain how we can see the body of an elevated spiritual personality if we see some disease. How is it possible for a spiritual body to experience birth, death, disease, and old age? Well, spiritual bodies don't experience birth, death, old age. But spiritualized material bodies do. So there's some similarity and difference between fire. So just like you have a fire and you put a pot on top of the fire, so the pot gets just as hot as the fire, but the pot is still a pot. Yes? If you touch a pot that's on the fire, you get burned just as much as if you touch the fire, but the pot is still a pot. So when a person becomes enlightened, even their physical body acts spiritually, and connection with their physical body will have spiritual effect. Eating the remnants of their food, taking the dust from their feet, etc., will give you spiritual effect because their body is spiritualized, but it's still a physical body. It's still going to get old, still going to die. It's not that if you fully use your body in Krishna's service, it's never going to die. Do you really want to stay in your body forever? Do you like your body that much? Is this material world of illusion and suffering a necessary part of the totality of things? Guess so. Must there always be suffering living entities? When we say must and necessary, perhaps from a certain perspective, no, but from a practical perspective, yes. It's sort of like saying, you know, can you ever have a society where every single person is a law-abiding citizen? Well, will you ever have such a society? Is that possible? That you can create, could we create a society where not one single human being made a choice ever to do anything criminal? You know, nobody has to do anything. It's not that somebody's forced to be a criminal. It's not that the government says, well, you know, we've got to have at least 2% of the population be criminals, so let's pick out these 2%, and you guys have to be criminals. So it's not necessary in that sense. It's not that Krishna says, okay, you guys have to be the conditioned souls to suffer now, because I need some conditioned souls. It's not like that. But necessary in the sense that in order to have free will, there has to be a way to express the misuse of that free will. You can't have freedom without having the other side of freedom. It just doesn't work. So, because Krishna is Swaraj, Raj comes from the word Raj, Swaraj, we call it in English autonomous. You can do what you want. Krishna is Swaraj, he's his own king. So we're all a little bit Swaraj. We have our own little autonomy. And having our own little autonomy means we can choose to do something foolish. And because there's pretty much always going to be somebody who chooses to do something foolish, therefore there's always an issue. The Nityamuktas like Srila Prabhupada, because they are eternally liberated, does it mean when they appear like they are engaged in ordinary activities, like Prabhupada's interest in politics, was he in Yoga Maya or Mahamaya? I would say that the liberated souls, whatever they do, everything that they do is part of Krishna's plan. Now, how exactly that plays out in their particular consciousness, I can't say. But everything they do is part of Krishna's plan. Everything they do is to set an example and then for teaching. And everything they do is pleasing to Krishna. Even if it apparently is something negative. Just like Bhishma chose to fight for the Kurus, thinking on a lower level of Dharma, well, they're maintaining me, I have to fight for them. Instead of, wait a minute, doing what's right is higher than who's maintaining me. So that was pleasing Krishna that he fought for the Kurus. Why was it pleasing Krishna that he fought for the Kurus? Well, on a Rasika level, because Krishna and Bhishma have this rasa of chivalry, they have a vira rasa. And in order for Bhishma and Krishna to be fighting, they had to be on opposite sides. You know, Arjuna was fighting with Krishna. He wasn't fighting, you know, as on the same time, on the same side, not against Krishna. So that part of it was that was their relationship. It was a loving fight. You know, like if you challenge your friend or your brother or sister to a game of chess, you know, or a game of whatever. We play games with our friends, yes? Where somebody wins and somebody loses? It's fun, right? Yes? So Krishna also likes to. So that's the main relationship that Bhishma has with Krishna. They play a game. So it's a game. So to do that, Bhishma had to be on the opposite side. Imagine if you wanted to play a game of chess, you know, checkers or something, or Scrabble with your family, and they said, well, because we're family members, we all have to play the same side. Even fun with that game. So that was one reason, and another reason was for the ordinary persons to see that even if you're Bhishma, even if you're the greatest warrior, that if you choose the wrong side, you're going to lose. That material strength and material expertise are not sufficient. There's the power of God, and many other reasons as well. So even sometimes when the great souls do something that appears to be not so proper, there's some other, something else going on. Does not mean that, particularly in yoga mind, and that's hard to say. There seems to be a trend towards more singing of kirtans and bhajans as opposed to reading the books of Srila Prabhupada. Do we have to make a choice? Is this all right, or should we give bhagavatam by Vigita more attention? Do we have to make a choice? Do we have to either have more kirtans or more shastra? Can we do more of both? All right. I should say, Srila Prabhupada says in Nectar Devotion, twice, two different places, that we should perform the nine processes according to our personal taste. So that's true in Vaidhi Bhakti, and certainly true in Radha Bhakti. So we have a certain baseline that Srila Prabhupada has given all of us. So everybody should study Prabhupada's books. If you want to advance quickly and easily and not get diverted, I mean, you can do what you want. But because Srila Prabhupada's books are the guidebooks for the journey, it's kind of like a map or a GPS. You know, if you don't really know where you're going and you don't regularly consult with your map or your GPS, you're probably going to get lost. Yes?
Yes.
Yes. So, good idea. It's a good idea. We highly recommend it. And if you don't consult with your map, you know, you may ask some stranger on the street, where do I go? And they may tell you the wrong directions. Please do not think that every single person who wears tilak and neckbeads and who's in the Hare Krishna movement is going to give you the right directions all the time. Maybe I shouldn't say that publicly, but I have to say it. Well, I'm a devotee, you know. Therefore, they're going to give you the right directions all the time. You know, they might not. You have to take some personal responsibility. You know the shastras. Now, does that mean that every single person has to study Prabhupada's books for 8 hours a day and, you know, become a great scholar and say, no. And we should be absorbed in kirtan. Prabhupada's giving us some basic kirtan. I mean, if you did the basics that Prabhupada asked everyone to do, which was Mangal Arati, deity greeting, and evening program, that would give you about maybe an hour and 20 minutes of kirtan a day. Maybe 2 hours. Somewhere between 1 to 2 hours of kirtan a day. So that's basic. So does everybody have to do 14 hours of kirtan a day? You know, Ayendra said when he was a new devotee that he was chanting 14 hours a day. Japa and kirtan. You know, he's chanting his rounds, going to the morning program, evening program, and going out of Harinam Sankirtan. Now, by the way, he had a vision of Krishna after 2 weeks of doing that. That doesn't mean you necessarily will. It doesn't mean that everybody has to be in kirtan for 14 hours a day. It doesn't mean that everybody has to read Srila Prabhupada's books for 14 hours a day. But there's a certain minimum. So if you follow the minimum that Prabhupada gave us for study, you know, like a half an hour Bhagavatam class in the morning, half an hour class, you know, like about an hour. At least Prabhupada said read a verse a day. You know, one of my god sisters should start reading, one of her friends said to her, at least a sentence a day. Something. So what I see as I travel all over the world is that ISKCON in general is putting more emphasis on Srila Prabhupada's books. There's a lot more places that are having organized shastric study programs, a lot more devotees taking time out of their life to have some concentrated time to study Srila Prabhupada's books. I also see a lot more emphasis on kirtan. I see a lot more like kirtan melas and harinams and extended kirtan programs. And I also see that in each temple, there's emphasis in different ways. And some of that reflects the personal emphasis of the leader. Any organization is going to reflect to some extent the personal emphasis of the leader. You can't help it, it's just the way it is. And it's also going to reflect the particular people who live in that community. So there are certain communities that I go to where there's so many kirtans. I mean, I was just in Cape Town. That was a real kirtan place. Mangalarti, so many devotees of Mangalarti, so many devotees of deity greeting, so many devotees in the evening, and there's always kirtan, 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 and the kirtans would go on, they were just full of enthusiasm. And then I go other places where there's lots and lots of Shastra classes and lots of seminars. If you want to find a place with both, go to Radhadesh. There you'll find lots and lots of kirtan and Bhakti Arta Manor, Vrindavan, Mayapur. So certain places are both kirtan hubs and study hubs. Then you go to some places and it's like a book distribution oasis, like Soho Street in London. Everybody's out distributing books. There's these huge bookstores, bookstores all the time. So different. And some places where they're really into preaching to the public. There's some places that have everything. No, no place has absolutely everything. In every place there's something missing, actually. Every place there's something missing. So even a place that, if I think of the places that have almost everything, something's not there. So places I know that have lots and lots of incredible kirtans and incredible shastric study and lots of people doing book distribution and really preaching to the public, maybe it's like a really bad place for women. So I know some old places. Or some places where like some huge section of the population is not being dealt with. There's some places where like the only people who come to the temple are white, or the only people who come are India. So some big chunk of the population that's nobody's relating to. So this just seems to be the way it is. Because I go to a lot of places. Lots and lots and lots and lots and lots and lots and lots. And I haven't seen a place that's top in everything. And it does everything right all the time. So if you're looking for that place, good luck. You find some places are really into prasanna. There's some places where everything's cooked by second-initiated devotees and offered to installed deities, and they use only ghee, and they don't use anything canned or anything frozen, and everything's really wonderful and healthy. It's full of bhakti, and you eat it, and you just feel full of health, and spiritual, and material, and mental, and vitality, and they're distributing prasanna to tons of people, and they have programs at the university where they distribute prasadam, and they have restaurants, and they have food for life, and this and that, and the other thing, they're really into the prasadam. And you have other places where they're really developing community. So I'm thinking, there's one place I know, they're really into prasadam, they have incredible kirtans, they're really into studying Srila Prabhupada's books, they have amazing deity worship, they have incredible, seminars, book distribution. They're really reaching out to all segments of the population. It's a really nice place for ladies, but they don't do anything to develop community. Nothing. It's the temple, and that's it. There's no society growing up around the temple. You understand? And then I know other places that are really into developing society. They're into building villages and helping people with their relationships and helping families get together and involving youth, and they have programs for all like that. And they're another place to think of like that. They're really into developing society, and they're really into their deity worship is the top of the top of the top. Their prasadam is just wow. The spiritual quality, the material, they grow most of their own food. Everything's just top rate with their prasadam. They do a lot of preaching to the general public. Study Prabhupada's books, moderate. Book distribution, moderate. It's just like that. So, if you're going to talk about a trend where? Which place? And you'll find, just like in the universe, each planet has its own opulences, So each center of this kind, every center, even little tiny ones. There's one little tiny center I know where there's literally one person who lives in the temple. And she does everything. But even the temple has its own opulences. So sweet. The relationships are really, really sweet. So, Mangalarti is kind of sparse. It's just Pujari. The relationships are very, very sweet. You mentioned on the platform of the body and the mind, we cannot experience eternal happiness. The body gets old, sick, etc. What happens to the mind? Aha. Well, doesn't your mind get full of anxiety sometimes? Anybody here have a mind that's never disturbed? Please raise your hand if your mind never gets disturbed. Oh, that's sad. The mind follows us from one body to the other, and once we no longer have any material thoughts, then the material mind is dissolved. The mind is made up of material thoughts and desire. That's what its substance is. You've all heard of people who can see ghosts? Yes? Yes? What does the ghost look like? What do the ghosts look like when people see a ghost? Do you know? Mm-hmm. Nobody knows. Well, what does it look like? There are people who can see ghosts. What do they see? Here you see the ghost of Mrs. Smith. What does it look like? Looks like Mrs. Smith, right? Yes? You know about this? Nobody knows about this one. I haven't seen ghosts, although I've been in places where I knew they were there. We once moved the temple in New York to a former old age home, and long story, I ended up being the only one in the 11-story building at one point before the devotees had moved in, and I was cleaning. That's a long story. Not important. But anyway, the lift was going up and down by itself, and the windows were going up and down by themselves. I didn't actually see the ghost. It didn't bother me. But if you can see a ghost, it looks like the way the person looked in life. Yes? You've heard about this? Yes, yes, yes. That means the subtle body is made of something. It has a form. So what's it made out of? It's made out of our thoughts, our feelings, and our desires, thinking, feeling, willing. Our determinations, our emotions, and our thoughts. Our determinations, emotions, and thoughts have substance. They're not nothing. They have substance. They exist. And they form that body, which is just a machine, actually. It's not us. So if you stop having material thoughts and material emotions and material desires, guess what happens to the subtle body? It stops existing. Just like if you stop feeding this gross body. Right? And that's how my mother passed away. She had Parkinson's and she couldn't eat anymore. She wasn't able to swallow. It was actually quite a nice death. It was. Materially and spiritually. She had a very nice day. But she couldn't eat. Gradually her body was wasted away. Yes? So if you don't eat material subtle things, guess what? Your material subtle body will just waste away. That's called liberation. The promise of liberation is the solution of the subtle body. The way I think of it, it's like, you know, if you buy a packet of seeds, they have these here, right? Like paper packets with seeds in them. So instead of opening up the packet, let's say you took the whole packet unopened and stuck it in a container of water, what would happen? It would dissolve, right? The packet would dissolve and the seeds would sprout. So that's basically bhakti yoga. You're taking the subtle body, you're immersing it in thoughts of Krishna. The essence of bhakti yoga is thinking of Krishna. The essence of bhakti yoga is thinking of Krishna. Is the essence of bhakti yoga. The essence of bhakti yoga is? Yes. Yes, so when you're absorbed in thinking of Krishna, when you take your thoughts, your emotions, and your desires, and you absorb them in Krishna, it dissolves the subtle body, and it awakens the spiritual body. Okay. Is it all right that I'm going on with the question? You okay with the time? You were mentioning our relationships with Krishna is most important. Somebody had to ask this. But our relationships with family and friends most of the time, if not all the time, becomes more important than our relationship with Krishna. How do we correct this? Okay, well, one way you can correct it is by a little thoughtfulness. A little thoughtfulness. Are your family and friends your shelter? Are your family and friends always there for you? Anybody here have family and friends who are absolutely always there for them in all circumstances, no matter what? Please raise your hand. Sad again. And even if they're there for you, can they always help you? Sometimes they just say, I'm really sorry. I hope it gets better. They just stand there, right? What are they going to do? I mean, when my daughter got hit by a truck, what was I supposed to do? What could I do? I could go to the hospital with her, and I could sit there when they did the tests, and I could be in the hospital room with her and figure that if it was lifelong paralysis, which thank you, Krishna, it wasn't, you know, what would we do with it? What was I supposed to do? What can I do? Our family and friends are not a shelter. Our family and friends cannot fulfill all of our needs and desires. They can't. Can anyone here fulfill all the needs and desires of their family and friends? Please raise your hand. Another sad thing. So they can't fulfill all of our needs and desires either. I compare it to like this little recording device. It's got a couple batteries in it, but it can't light up this building. So your family and friends, they have power. They don't have enough power to meet all of our desires. They just don't. So have a little intelligence. Why is my relationship with a AA battery more important than my relationship with the electric company? It's pretty simple. And our family and friends, probably, are also struggling with their own stuff. Yes? Probably. Unless you have a family of all liberated souls. All your friends and family of all liberated souls. Very nice. But if they're not, they're also struggling with their own desires and their own attachments. They're sometimes going to be selfish and greedy and angry, right? And they're their own stuff. Why make that relationship more important than a relationship with the perfect, unlimited person who can give you total shelter and fulfill all of your desires eternally and isn't struggling with any stuff? Why? It's a little thoughtfulness, which helps, by the way. To get that thoughtfulness, it really, really helps if you're reading the books, because that will remind you of that. You'll get reminded every time you read the books. Oh, yeah, my family and friends are just little plastic soldiers. Could you imagine, you know, if these people, they have this, everybody has these armed response and security thing signs. Could you imagine if in front of your gate you had two plastic soldiers? Protected by plastic soldiers. That's our family and friends, my dear friends. Plastic soldiers. You just had a recording of a dog barking, you know, people say, well, yeah. A real dog. have a tape of a dog going. So also, another interesting thing is you can't really love your family and friends unless you love Krishna first. You just can't. How much time do I have?
You can go on to help us.
I can, okay. Because this is a nice point, but... If I don't love Krishna first, all right, this is kind of deep, folks. If I don't love Krishna first, if I don't have that connection with Krishna, I'm going to feel empty. I'm feeling disconnected. It's an illusion that I'm disconnected. It's not the reality, but my impression is that I'm disconnected. The famous Thomas Merton, who, I don't know if he's still... Ah, here it is. Thomas Merton, Catholic theologian, monk, and author. Wrote a nice, it's right there. Wrote a nice appreciation. He said that all of us have a God-shaped vacuum in our heart. Now, God's unlimited. You know the story of when Mother Yasoda is breastfeeding Krishna and the milk boils over? So Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur said that the milk was thinking, because spiritual milk can think, you know. So the milk was thinking, Krishna's belly is unlimited and Mother Yasoda's milk is unlimited. I'm never going to get a turn. So Krishna's unlimited, therefore we have a God-shaped vacuum in our heart. It's unlimited. I'm feeling unlimitedly empty. And I'm thinking, my family and friends, maybe you're thinking your computer or your car or whatever, we're thinking something and someone is going to fill that void. But they can't because they're limited. They're tiny. So our relationships with others are then on the platform of taking. Please try to understand this. This is the difference between love and lust. Again, this is a very difficult, painful, and heavy thing. But I'm smiling because that doesn't make any sense. So, our material relationships are really all lust and exploitative. Does that help if I smile? Does it help a little bit? And I'm not talking to any of you. I'm talking to the ceiling. Maybe that helps too. None of you. But none of us, just me, no. My, all your relationships are pure. My relationships are less than you started. That helps a little bit. But basically, when we have this feeling of being empty, when we think we're disconnected with Krishna, what I'm doing is I'm, that's why I said, didn't I say that it's hard to see the truth? I did say that, man. I did warn you. You could have left then. You could even leave now, because I've gone over time. So you can leave right now before I say this next thing, because you're not going to like it. When I'm dealing with other people, I'm dealing with them to take. I'm trying to take something from them to fill my emptiness. That is not love. Now, a person in the tamagun, we're talking here about the gunas, a person in tamagun just steals. It's called vikarma. I want something from you, I'm going to take it. Stealing and rape, literal and figurative. I want something from you, I'm going to take it. Whether you want to give it to me or not is irrelevant. And that's our society, when I say our society, the whole world society is basically in this vikarma. I want something from the earth, I'm going to take it. I want something from the animals, I'm going to take it. I want something from people who are weaker than me, I'm going to take it. Yes? Is this basically the mood? Modern society, whatever I want, I'm going to take. And then we wonder why there's so much theft and rape in the world. Because the whole mood is stealing and raping. Yes? Stealing and raping means I'm going to take something from you that you don't want to give me. I'm going to take it by force. So a person who's a little bit more intelligent is on the platform of karma. And they say, well, if I want to get something, I should pay for it. I should have an exchange. So a civilized person in a civilized society pays for things. I'm going to take food from the earth, I need to nourish the earth. I want to take something from a store, I pay for it. I give them something in exchange. I want to take some pleasure from another person, I give them some pleasure in exchange. But you'll notice that this mood of exchange, as long as one is still materialist, this is mode of passion. Now we come up to the mode of passion, karma. Karma is righteous. Mode of passion is righteousness. I'm a righteous, a good person. But you notice that even in this mood, we always want to get a little bit more than what we give. We always want what we're willing to pay, but we want to get a bargain. Yes? And does anybody feel bad when they get something on sale from the store? Do you ever tell your friends, I'm so sad I bought this on sale. The people in the store are losing money. But in all of our relationships, it's like that. Even with our family and friends. Right? The husband and wife, they're subtly keeping score. And you're willing to give and give and give, but at a certain point it's like, okay, now I want to get and get and get. And you're willing to be, you know, in debt a little bit for a while, but you want it in balance to be on your side. So that's karma. So vikarma or karma, the mood is exploiting. One is exploiting sinfully, and one is exploiting piously. But the mood is still exploiting. The mood is still me at your expense. So uncivilized, me at your expense, I take. Civilized, me at your expense, I pay, but I want to get it on sale. Is that clear? Does anybody ever go to a store and say, I'd like to pay you more than the value of this? And we don't do that with our relationships either. We might do it temporarily, but then we want something back later. Okay? That's not love. And it can't satisfy us because it's not who we really are. We are not actually exploiters and takers and thieves. That is not who and what we are. That's false. That cannot satisfy. We are looking for love. That echo is cool. We're looking for love. What does love mean? Love means I give to you and I don't care about return. Now, how do you do that? The only way you can do that is if you're full and overflowing. It's the only way you can do it. If you're empty, you can't give without thinking about return. Is it possible? It's not possible. You have to think about return. But we're not empty. That's an illusion. We're full. As soon as we remember, oh, I'm connected with Krishna, he's full. Take the complete away from the clean, it's still complete. And you see that a little bit with the sun. The sun keeps giving out light and it doesn't burn up. I mean, eventually it will. It doesn't burn up. Or a spring of water just keeps flowing. So when we feel connected with Krishna, then that vacuum, God-shaped vacuum in our heart is full, and it's unlimited. And it's so full that it's overflowing. Now when I'm full of love, then I can love others. Then I can actually love others. Then I can give without caring, as Krishna says in Gita. They have no need to depend on any other living being. Then I'm no longer dealing with you to get something from you, because I already have everything. Is that clear to everybody? If I have everything, then all of my relationships are free and voluntary. If I feel needy, then I feel an inner compulsion to have relationships with others and to do things to get something. I mean, it's not pleasant, is it? Isn't that unpleasant, that feeling? Yes?
Yep.
But when we're full, there's the only thing that's compelling me to relate to others is that I want to share my joy. I don't need anything from anybody. I have no need to depend on any other living being. I need nothing from anybody. Whether everybody yells at me and throws stones at me, or everybody praises me and throws flowers at me, it's irrelevant. Then I can love. That's love. So we love Krishna first. When we saw Prabhupada in 76, so my 1.5-year-old son.
How old is that little baby there?
8 months.
8 months when my boy was about 1.5. So he was sitting on my lap just like that. And Prabhupada said, just like this mother. Is that a boy or a girl?
Yeah.
It's a girl. So Prabhupada said, just like this mother is loving her child without any expectation of return, in that way you should love Krishna. And then my father, Ashwini Prabhupada, can loving her son help him to love Krishna? Prabhupada said, no. But loving Krishna will help him to love her son. So love Krishna first. Now that doesn't mean you wait until you love Krishna. Okay. First, I'm going to totally love Krishna. And in the meantime, I'm going to be mean to everybody else. After I love Krishna, then I'll be nice to you. Is Krishna going to like that? No. So what you do is you love others to please Krishna, not to get something from them. You be nice to your wife. Please be nice to your wife. Please be nice to your husband. Please be nice to your children. Please be nice to your friends. Please be nice to your parents. But not so your parents will like you, and so your wife will like you, and so your husband will like you, and so your children will like you, but so Krishna will smile. Then you're free. You know, on Monday you bring your wife flowers, and she says, oh, thank you. And on Tuesday you bring her flowers, and she said, do you think you can get whatever you want just by bringing me flowers? And you go, well, what's the use of this? Because the motive was to get something back. You understand? Clear?
Yes.
But if I'm giving my wife a flower, because Krishna will be pleased if I treat my wife with respect. Please, serving others is part of serving Krishna. And the person I'm trying to please is Krishna. I'm only trying to please Krishna. I'm not trying to please anybody separate from Krishna. Ever. Okay. Last one. Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna. Can you please explain the difference between the material energy and the spiritual energy, since Krishna is everything? Okay, we now have 30 seconds. It says in the 14th chapter of the Krishna book that Maya exists only within the mind. The difference between the material and spiritual energy is how we perceive. Krishna gave the definition of Maya. Whatever appears to be of value, if it is without relation to me, has no reality. Know it to be my illusory energy, that reflection which appears to be of darkness. If you see things as separate from Krishna, and you see that you're the Lord of everything, and you're perfect, powerful, and happy, and you're the doer, then you're in the illusory energy. And if you see our part of Krishna, and Krishna is everywhere, then you're in the spiritual energy. From Krishna's perspective, everything is a spiritual energy. Thank you very much. All glories to Shri Prabhupada.